Today's Teisho will be on case 29 in the Hikigan Roku in the Pien Lu, the Blue Rock Collection, the Blue Cliff Record. Case 29 is entitled Dai Zui, It Will Be Gone with the Other. Engo's introduction. Fish swimming. The water is disturbed. A bird flying, a feather falls. Host and guest are clearly distinguished. Black and white are sharply divided. It is like a clear mirror on the stand and a bright jewel in the hand. When a man of Han appears, he is reflected. If a man of Ho comes, he is mirrored. Sound is manifest, color is apparent. How will it be like that? See the following. Main subject. A monk asked Dai Zui, when the Kalpa fire flares up and the great cosmos is destroyed, I wonder, will it perish or will it not perish? Zui said, it will perish. The monk said, then it will be gone with the other. Zui said, it will be gone with the other. Secho's verse, blocked by the double barrier, the monk asked from the heart of the Kalpa fire, wonderful the words, it will be gone with the other. Thousands of miles he wandered in vain seeking a master. So I would like again to thank everybody for the wonderful sitting this morning in the Zendo, in our virtual Zendo. Everybody was sitting so still, I can see the screen and moving, sit after sit. It's really wonderful, it's thrilling, really. Really wonderful to meet people who want to practice like this amazing path of Zen, the great way, and dropping body and mind in deep mushin and fusing with the 10,000 things. The great Japanese teacher Dogen said, you know, to practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to become one with all things, with the 10,000 things. So, you know, studying the self is, I think, itself a great achievement. You know, when people realize that, you know, there are many things wrong with the world, to say the least. When people realize, though, that even though it's true that there are many things wrong with the world, there might be something wrong with them, might be something amiss with them, that's a really momentous occasion. That's a really wonderful thing. And actually, many people never reach that conclusion. You know, many people blame circumstances all their lives, and they see themselves all their lives as simply innocent victims of circumstances. When people begin to realize, you know, maybe I have a problem, maybe there's something with me, you know, why do I yell at everybody all the time anyway? You know, and there's a certain kind of person who will say, of course I yell, they're annoying, right? And there's a kind of person who would say, well, maybe I don't have to yell. Why do I do that? See, so studying the self is actually a real achievement, right? You know, to study the self, Dogen says, is to forget the self. And that's what we do in at least part of Zen practice is forgetting the self, right? You know, at some point, you know, at first you blame circumstances, and then later you begin to realize that maybe part of the issue is me. You know, maybe I'm part of the problem. And then, you know, the more you look into this thing called the me or the I, you know, in a way, the more fugitive or elusive it becomes, right? It's like, well, you know, finally, what is this I? You know, the more we explore the self, the more insubstantial the self becomes. It becomes very hard to separate the self from the conditions that have surrounded us in our lives. So, you know, if you ask somebody, well, what if your mother hadn't been your mother? What if somebody else had been your mother? And it, again, there's a kind of naive response, which might be, oh, that would be wonderful, or, oh, that would be terrible, right? You know. But then you realize, well, wait, if my mother hadn't been my mother, I wouldn't be me. I wouldn't be here, right? And so what does it mean to be me if the fact that my mother not being here would mean that I'm not here too? That the self is a lot less firm and solid than we thought. You know, and the more we look for the self, as I say, the more elusive it becomes. You know, some people respond to that anxiety by clinging to the idea that there's a self there somewhere, right? I would say. I remember when I was living in Seattle, one of my best friends was a man named John Gimbel, Jonathan Gimbel, and he is actually a Asian medicine specialist. He practices now in Santa Fe, but John was in our Sangha. He was a Sangha member, and he eventually moved to Santa Fe, where he's been practicing for many years very successfully. And he's an acupuncturist and traditional Chinese medicine doctor. He's licensed. But at any rate, he was going to school to study traditional Chinese medicine at that time. And there's a university in Seattle that teaches that. But I met his wife, and his wife, who's not his wife anymore, I'm sorry to say, but was a charming person. But, you know, she said to me something once. We were having coffee at a restaurant in Seattle called the 14 Carat Cafe, which probably doesn't exist anymore. But she said, you know, I'll say her name was Susan. It wasn't Susan. But she said, you know, I believe that I have always been Susan through countless lives. Through countless lives, I've always been Susan. And I didn't know what to say. I mean, I certainly wasn't going to get into an argument about whether that belief was justified or not, and I was happy that it was comforting to her. You know, it's definitely reassuring as you sort of close in on the insubstantial nature of the self to believe that there's something there that's always going to be there. And it's worth investigating. You know, there's actually a koan called "Who is he? Who is he?" And that means me. Who is he? So it's worth investigating the self. And of course, everybody is free to reach their own conclusions about that. But Dogen says that, you know, to study the self, to study the self is to forget the self. You know, at some point you realize that maybe the self is not what we're really after, right? Maybe the self is not the solution, but the problem, you know? You know, I mentioned yesterday that the Buddha, you know, the Buddha's great discovery was that, you know, in Western thinking, there's a very famous philosopher named Descartes, and Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. But the Buddha said, oh no, that's not true. He didn't know Descartes. He was born about 2,000 years before Descartes. But he said, you know, thinking comes first and then we imagine there's a thinker. But thinking has its sources in a place that the thinker doesn't control, see? So, you know, even your thoughts don't actually come from you, if you have to put it that way. You don't choose your thoughts, you don't choose your feelings. They arise in your awareness and then they go away and you don't get to choose. So anyway, Dogen says, to practice Zen is to study the self, to realize it's not all circumstances, right? You know, there's something going on with you. But then when you look for the self, you realize, you know, maybe it's the illusion of the self that's causing me all this unhappiness, see? And then Dogen says, you know, letting go of the self can seem like this terrible thing, this terrible loss, you know, and it can, you know, letting go of the self is, you know, if you, it can feel like losing everything, right? But then, you know, strangely, when you let go of the self, Dogen says, you become one with everything around you. One with everything around you. And some of you have experienced that oneness with everything around you here at this sesshin and at other sesshins. It's, if you've been practicing Zen for a while, that's probably why you're continuing to practice. Yeah. When I got interested in Zen, I was in graduate school, or I was starting graduate school at the University of Washington. And, you know, as somebody who had been living on a commune for a couple of years, you know, I got out of undergraduate school and I went to live like in a hippie world. And then I realized, you know, this is not necessarily going anywhere for me. And I went back to graduate school. It was very stressful because I had gotten out of the academic routines, right? And I was in a very high pressure environment. And the pressure was bothering me so much. In those days, I think as a TA, I made something like, I think it might've been $5,000 a year, really. And I couldn't really afford therapy, but I did go to this Tibetan center in Seattle. It was what's called a Dharma Datu. It was part of Chogyam Trungpa's organization. And they had a room where you could just go in for free and sit. And I had read some books about meditation. I would just go in there and meditate for like a half an hour or a little bit more, and I would feel so much better. And then, you know, there was no resident teacher there, so I ran into a person who was sitting there one morning, and the person said, did you hear that a Japanese Roshi, a Japanese Zen teacher, has come to Seattle, and he's holding meditation sessions at the University of Washington on Wednesday nights? So I, of course, went. I was a student at the University of Washington, and I went, and there was indeed a group that was meeting, and there was indeed a Zen teacher. Takabayashi Genki Roshi was his name. And I started doing meditation. I had only gone to do meditation a couple weeks, maybe like a month or so, maybe 6 weeks. The woman who was the main organizer of the community was a woman named Wendy Nicow. And Wendy Nicow later became the abbot of the Los Angeles Zen Center. So, but she was this very attractive and charming person. And she came up to me with a big smile and said, would you like to go to sesshin? And she was so... she was, you know, quite a lovely person. And I said, yes, of course. What's a sesshin? So then I went to a sesshin and I found out what it means to do 8 hours of meditation a day. And it was quite a shocker for me. My legs hurt quite a bit. But, you know, when it was all over and I went back to my regular life, even though that first session, there was a lot of sore legs. I mean, really, really, my legs were sometimes, you know, hurt a lot. But when I went back to my life, everything was different. I just felt so much better. And I would go to the Zen Center almost every day and sit. And sitting was physically difficult for me, you know. My legs hurt a lot. It was hard for me to be straight. I had to have straight back. But, you know, sometimes I would even be covered with perspiration, you know, just be like covered with sweat after 20 minutes. But I would leave the Zen Center feeling so purified, so wonderful. So to practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to become one with the 10,000 things, to become one with all things. So that's Dogen's take on all this, and this is a little bit different. This is Dazui's take on all this. A monk asked Dazui, when the kalpa fires flare up and the great cosmos is destroyed, I wonder, will it perish or will it not perish? See, in it you can't see it, but in the passage, it is in quotation marks. You could also translate it as this. In Zen, when we want to talk about enlightened experience or enlightenment, they sometimes say this or this matter. So in a lot of Zen teishos and talks, even in the Shinshin Ming, you know, he'll say this sometimes, and it means this very moment, which is the core of reality, basically. So, you know, this koan involves the belief that Buddhists have. And, you know, in Western religion, there's this idea of an apocalypse, right? The idea of an apocalypse. In Christianity, there's the idea of the apocalypse, right? But in Islam too, there's an actual end of the world. It's called the Yawm al-Din, the Day of Judgment. And the world is going to end and everybody's going to be judged. And that will be the end of the world. That's the Western view. You know, in Buddhist, the Buddha himself said, don't worry about stuff like that. People asked him, they said, when did the world begin? The Buddha said, oh, who cares? Don't worry about stuff like that. And they said, well, when will it end? He said, who cares? You know, sit on the cushion, achieve enlightenment. But nevertheless, you know, after the Buddha died, people began to ask, When did it begin? When will it end, right? So there is such a thing as Buddhist cosmology. And if you would have to choose between studying Buddhist cosmology and meditating, please meditate. Okay. But if you have a spare moment and you're curious, you can read. You know, the Buddhist universe is centered around a giant mountain called Sumeru. Mount Sumeru is the center of the universe. And it's almost like a constellation, right? Mount Sumeru, and then around it are all these worlds. And our world is one of the worlds. It's called Jambudvipa. It's called Black Plum Island. You didn't know, we call it Earth, but ancient Buddhists called it Black Plum Island. And Black Plum Island is the world we live on. In Buddhist teaching, eventually there will be the kalpa fires, the end of a world age. In Buddhist cosmology, there's a little kalpa and there's a big one. And The little one is very big, right? It's longer than, it's like longer than the 15 million billion years ago, 15 billion years that the universe has existed, the 13.5 billion years that the universe has existed. The long one is really long, but at the end of the long one, there's going to be a kalpa fire that will destroy everything. This is part of Buddhist cosmology. But, you know, unlike in the West, everything will come back, right? So everything's going to be destroyed and everything's going to come back. You know, this is interesting. You know, there also, you might not realize this because, you know, in Buddhist imagination, about the Buddhist imaginary, its way of understanding the universe, there's actually heavens and hells that correspond actually to states of mind. So they're really states of mind. So, you know, there are various hell realms, and we've all been there at various moments in our life. And there's various heavens, you know. So actually, you know, when you sit down on the cushion and you enter deep samadhi, there, it can be, feel very blissful and peaceful. That's actually a heaven. There's a heaven of that particular samadhi, and all the beings there live in that samadhi. And then, you know, when you enter a state of timelessness, there's a timeless heaven, and so on. So, and there are all these hells, you know, when you have a bad day and everything goes wrong and you're just out of sorts, there's a hell called having a bad day and you're out of sorts. But nobody stays in hell. And, you know, if you do some bad things, if you kill somebody, you're going to be reborn for a long time as pariah dogs and things like that. But first you go to hell. And depending on how terrible your crime, you go to hell for a while until you undergo a change of heart. And then when you realize you've done a bad thing and you regret it, you know, you're out of hell. And now you start working your way up. But in Buddhist imagination of the world, this kalpa fire is terrifying, you know. And, you know, at times it feels like we're at the end of times right now, right? Okay. So a monk said to Daizui, when the kalpa fire flares up and the great cosmos is destroyed, will it be destroyed? See? You know, will this be destroyed? So, you know, basically this is, it is the most sacred thing. See, the most sacred thing. So, you know, when you sit down on the cushion, you know, you might at first have, you know, maybe if this is your first or second sesshin, this might be really challenging for you. And it might be very difficult. You might have a lot of pain in your legs and you might go through a whole sesshin and, you know, you just have a few little insights, you know, and you think, boy, this is a lot of work. It's not necessarily so wonderful, right? You hear me talk glowingly about sesshin. But eventually, you know, if you go to sesshin for a long time, you'll begin to have these experiences where you encounter something in your own immediate experience, which is sort of like unspeakably, you could say sacred if you wanted to, sacred, precious, luminous, you know, love, unlimited love, and so on and so on. And, you know, the more you practice Zen, the more you have those experiences. And at first, they're just a little glimpse, you know. You're on day four of sesshin, and suddenly you just feel, you're just sort of filled with love, right? You remember all the people in your life who have helped you, your 10th grade teacher, you know, mentors, and, you know, maybe the day before you were thinking about all the people who made you abjectly miserable, and, you know, but you got up the next day and you went back to the cushion and suddenly there's like this explosion and you realize, you know, you think about, I had a teacher in the 10th grade, Mrs. Brown, and Mrs. Brown, you know, was a genius, really. You know, now she wouldn't be teaching high school, right? Now she'd be a professor at some university. But in those days, her parents were immigrants, fleeing Germany, and she made her living as a teacher. And she was a fantastic, when I think back on how much time she lavished on our papers and on us, I can't believe it. It's, when did she sleep? But she was totally into this, and she was totally generous. She was bodhisattva, right? And, I've had since where I suddenly realized, oh my gosh, what an amazing, I didn't appreciate Mrs. Brown. She was the kind of teacher that if you went in during your study hall to see Mrs. Brown and she was having her lunch, she would actually talk to you about Les Miserables, right? About Jean Valjean. And, she was an amazing, she gave me so much, right? And I've had since where I suddenly realized, oh my gosh, what a wonderful person, what an amazing human being. I realized who she was and what she gave to me, and I'm just overwhelmed with gratitude. It's like, oh, how beautiful this is, right? So, believe it or not, that's like a moment of enlightenment. That's like a glimpse of enlightenment, right? And the more you practice, the more you have these, moments where they're like openings, right? Openings. Kensho means opening. So when somebody says, I've had a Kensho experience, what it really means is I've had an opening. And when you have this opening, this luminous compassion, comes rushing through. And as we keep practicing Zen, this happens more and more and more and more. And so little by little, we become, as I said yesterday, like empty cells, right? And, when you empty out, you could say when you empty out, the light rushes in, right? Zen practice is about going through this process of emptying out and emptying out again and again. And sometimes it's hard to empty out, right? Because we have attachments and we have fears, right? So, there's a voice in our head saying, if I do this, I'm going to lose everything. It may not speak so clearly, but, we're often hanging on to our chains because we know them, because they're familiar to us and they're reassuring, right? They're reassuring to us. They're actually comforting. It's like that's a problem, right? That sometimes the thing about liberation is it's hard to get to because we hold on to the things that hold us in bondage, and we hold on sometimes for dear life. So one way to understand Dazui's question, Dogen makes it sound a little too easy. This is why I brought in Dogen. Let me just say, Dogen just makes it sound great, right? But there's a hard part to this. It's a little more complicated because he says, forget the self, and now onto the dessert, right? But the forgetting the self is the hard part, and it's not so much forgetting the self as remembering and then letting go. It's like a lot of Zen practice is remembering and then letting go, right? So, it would be nice when we sit down on the cushion if we could just have bliss, right? You just sit down on the cushion and bliss. Going to a Zen retreat, everybody thinks, oh, how wonderful, 5 days of bliss, But it's not 5 days of bliss. It's hard work. It's hard work. Now, if you're having bliss, I'm not knocking it, and don't feel you should be suffering, okay? Enjoy it, right? See, I'm not criticizing if you're happy, right? But what I'm saying is that sometimes we don't want to be happy, actually, right? We don't want to be happy. But because our unhappiness is so reassuring to us, right? So you know, when the monk comes in and says to Dai Zui, you know, when the kalpa fire comes, will it be destroyed? You know, he's saying a number of things. You know, maybe we all have a different it. You know, maybe your it is your reputation, you know. So, or your so-called career, maybe. And I'm not urging anybody to quit their jobs. I'm just saying sometimes we take our career identities a little too seriously, you know. So for example, when I was in graduate school, I mentioned earlier, I started doing Zen and I got really into it. I would go to sesshins. I went to 4 or 5 sesshins every year with Genki Roshi. And we generally had one per season, you know. And I would just take off and go to a sesshin. And I remember one time, my graduate director said to me, "So are you going to MLA?" And I said, "No, I'm not." And he said, "Well, why not?" And I said, "I have a previous engagement." And he said, "Well, what's the engagement?" And I said, "Well, I practice Zen and I'm going to a sesshin." And he was furious. He said, "What, you know, like, what the hell is wrong with you?" You know, he said, "A sesshin, you know, it was saying, I'm busting my chops to make you professionally successful, and you're going off to, you know, to a job in the circus. You're going to go work in the circus, you know." And I'm so glad I didn't listen to him, you know, and I went to sesshin. You know, I had to sort of let my prospects be destroyed in a way, you know. I had to be willing to let my prospects be a little bit destroyed in order to go to sesshin. And as it turns out, he wasn't a great graduate director anyway. And it didn't help me that much anyway, right? So, but the point is, I had to give something up a little bit to do this. I had to not worry so much about his approval, right? And I had to let that be destroyed a little bit. So you know, we all have an it. You know, we all have an it. It's something, if I lose this, I've lost everything, right? And when we think that way, that's like, those are the heavy, the tightest, heaviest, most complete chains we could possibly create, right? Those are the chains that's the best straitjacket anybody ever invented. If I lose this, I've lost everything, see? So if I had thought that way when my director said, "You shouldn't go to sesshin, you should go to MLA," I would have gone home and gone, "Oh my God, you know, what is going to become of me? You know, if I don't get a job, I'm going at a university, I'll be driving a bus, you know?" And as it turns out, one of my friends from the graduate program got a PhD and he did a dissertation on William Carlos Williams, and he drove a bus and he wrote this wonderful poetry, you know? So it all worked out okay for him, right? I could have said, "Oh my God, I'll drive a bus." And then I could have said, what will I do? I could have imagined all these things that would have happened or not have happened to me. And in that way, I would have closed the whole world off to myself. When the kalpa fires come, will this be destroyed? And Dai Zui says, yes, it's going to be destroyed. It's got to be destroyed. It's got to be destroyed. See? Actually, even if you cling to the sacred, or you cling to the Dharma, or you cling to enlightenment, those become straitjackets too. You know, it all has to be destroyed. It all has to be destroyed in the kalpa fire, right, so to speak. So what I really mean is you have to let go of everything. You know, I've talked about this before. You know, sometimes people in a sesshin have amazing experiences. So somebody will come in and just say, you know, I just feel the love pouring out of myself, right? And it's like, ah, a kensho, how wonderful for you, right? And, you know, and then they leave the Dokusan room and they go to sleep, and the next day they get up and it's like, okay, bring on the love, right? Bring on the, you know, and there's no love. It's like, where is it? Where did it go? And, you know, they can remember what that was like. They could remember, you know, yesterday I was in this state and it was so beautiful. See, it was so beautiful. And now it's gone. And they'll come into the Dokusan, it's gone. Where did it go? And it's like, no, you're blocking. You're blocking. See, you've had this experience and you've formed a mental image of it. And now you're trying to go back to basically this mental image and make it repeat. See? So you've taken something that is a great breakthrough and you've turned it into an obstacle. See? So, you know, every door can become a barrier. That's why the collection of koans is called the Gate of No Barrier. Every door can become a barrier, but every barrier is a door, see, if we let it be destroyed. And letting it be destroyed doesn't mean, you know, you try to destroy it on the cushion. It means you let it go. Even if you meet the Buddha face to face, please let it go. Tomorrow is another day. See? Tomorrow's another day. And so, you know, what the way of Zen is constantly letting go. Constantly. You could say destroying if you want to be dramatic about it. You know, when everything is gone, what you have left is everything. See? Whenever you thought was most precious is gone, what you have left is the 10,000 things, is everything. Only what you have now is the freedom, the permission to experience the world in a new way. See, the permission. You know, I'm so glad I didn't listen to that graduate director who told me, don't go to Sesshin. And instead I went to Sesshin and I met a guy who was a brain scientist in the medical school, John Sunston, who's been my lifelong friend. And Sunston was a professor who actually did a lot of Zen. And I thought, wow, you know, I guess you can do that. You could be a professor and you could practice Zen. You know, that's okay. So, you know, I kind of gave up on my career in a certain way. I have a career, but I gave up on the career I thought I was going to have. And I was willing to just be open to the possibilities, right? I don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. I don't know, you know? But I knew I had to go to the Sesshin, and I did, and I'm so glad I did. You know, and I've never stopped. You know, in 40 years, you have to be, you know, so how do you destroy? Well, the way you destroy is to sit on the cushion and go into deep mushin. So you sit down on the cushion and you go into deep mushin and your mind is blank, and then sometimes stuff comes up from the hell realm or from the intermediate realms, right, from the world of form. You know, you remember painful times or difficult times. And you go through, they arise before you, and you go into mushin, and gradually they're transformed and you're transformed. You let them go, right? They stop. At first, you know, you remember, I was thinking the other day on the cushion, I was sitting on the cushion, and all of a sudden, Bobby Westbrook came up. And Bobby Westbrook, when I was living in Baltimore, lived in the same apartment complex as I did, and he used to beat me up almost every day, and I just couldn't win. You know, he was much bigger and stronger than I was, and he still frightens me even now, right? So Bobby Westbrook came up, and I'm feeling that fear, and I just keep going into mushin, and gradually, you know, the fear goes away, and I realize now he was a really unhappy little kid. I think his father had walked out on his mother, And his mother was a single mom who had a job working with this, working, and this poor little boy was at home all the time. And he would come over and, you know, he really wanted to be my friend in a strange way. I'm sure this is true. And, you know, when I would sort of rebuff him, that's when he would beat me up. That'll make you my friend. I'll beat you up. But the thing is, you know, after a while, the fear stops arising and I can see him with compassion and move on. See, going into Mushin, I'm purifying body, mind, and heart in this way, working through the karma. And, you know, and then, you know, you have these wonderful experiences after that. You know, you see Bobby Westbrook and your heart is filled with love and you have to let that go too. You know, we just keep going. We keep going back into Wuxin and purifying. And we let everything go. So to practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to let the self go. And when you let the self go, you become one with all things. A monk asked Daizui, when the Kalpa fires flare up and the great cosmos is destroyed, the thing you care most about, I wonder, will it, the thing you care most about, perish or will it not perish? And we're expecting him to say, oh, no, it won't perish. There's one thing that will never fail you. There's a rock of ages and so on and so on. See, he says, nope, it's got to go. Even the rock of ages has to go. See, it all has to go. It will perish. The monk said, then it will be, he can't believe it. He said, then it will be gone? So he said, it will be gone. See? But, you know, there's a punchline that we don't get here, right? When it's really gone, everything comes back. Secho's verse, blocked by the double barrier, the monk asked from the heart of the Kalpa fire. Wonderful words, wonderful words. It will be gone with the other. Thousands of miles he wandered in vain seeking a master.